Hello, everyone. This is Milton Cornwell, COO of Copper Peak Logistics, and I'm excited to share another installment of our expert series for the wine industry. Today, I have Brian Baker with me again. He really needs no introduction, but for anyone that doesn't know him, his background in the wine and hospitality space is extensive and includes senior leadership positions at Jackson Family, Chateau Montelena, and Maya Kama's Vineyards. We first caught up with him in 2020, right after the pandemic had hit, and got into many topics, most of which were related to winery strategies to navigate the closing of tasting rooms and the related fallout from that. Most of Brian's insights have become reality across the wine industry. So welcome back, Brian.
Thank you, Milton. It's a pleasure to be back with you again.
So today we're going to focus on another interesting trend involving international wines in the U.S. and how it continues to grow, perhaps even given a little jumpstart from the COVID e-commerce buying habits. But first off, tell us what you are doing now and what you are seeing out there in general.
Generally, we're seeing an increase in the number of import brands that want to assess and access the United States DTC market. They are looking abroad at the United States as the largest consumption market, see that with COVID, online strategies have been proven, and they want to get a piece of that. They want to come in and figure out how it can be done.
So let's start with how international brands have traditionally entered the U.S. market, not necessarily for D2C, but how have brands gotten here in the first place?
Well, traditionally, an import brand would hire an importer here in the U.S., and that importer would bring their product in. That importer would then, dependent on their license structure, help retail it, so to speak, to wholesalers, or in some cases, even to retailers. That was the traditional model. The import brand had a certain amount of control in that if they so chose, they could be over here helping to do those sales in market. But for the most part, it was conversations that took place by phone and fax and email. You've got the container coming, and I hope we can get it moved through the accounts you've set up for me.
So very much that three-tier model.
Traditional three-tier, absolutely.
So now, today, what's driving their interest in the direct-to-consumer model? It might be obvious, pandemic, but, you know.
It's pandemic. It's COVID. It's the shutdown, as we saw all over the world, of on-premise channels. It's wineries looking at inventory that they can't move anymore, dependent upon whether they had access to off-premise traditional retail in Europe or other markets, Australia, South America in particular. They had a lot of inventory on hand. And In some cases, they may not have been that sophisticated in online and or a internal direct-to-consumer traditional loyalty program like a club. I can certainly tell you that the tasting room model that we take for granted here in the U.S. is not widely distributed or understood in other markets, Australia being one of the exceptions. So the pandemic forced them to say, where else can we sell this wine? And when they start looking at the math, they go, well, got our own backyard, but hey, look at across the ocean or up the peninsula, you know, the isthmus. We've got this, the United States with the largest consumption of wine in the world. Why don't we get in there?
It's very, very obvious for them to look this way. So as we all know, three-tier is completely different than direct-to-consumer. Can you elaborate on some of the nuances and differences?
Well, I mean, three-tier by its implication implies that there's three different levels of transaction. The supplier, the brand owner, sells the wine to a wholesaler. This is a domestic model, and that wholesaler then sells to a retailer, to a restaurant, or to an independent wine store, or a chain, or grocery store. With an import brand, you actually have almost a fourth tier, because you've got an import partner that has to bring the wine in legally to the U.S., and then it has to go into wholesale and into retail. Compared to a direct-to-consumer channel, which means that supplier, that brand owner, is essentially selling their product directly to that consumer, for example, over a shopping cart that's on the website. And then that product is shipped to that person, that buyer, the last mile, and it doesn't have to go through a restaurant. It doesn't have to go through a grocery store. It doesn't have to go through a wholesaler. That's the traditional domestic DTC model, which with many, many years of struggle with efforts by Free the Grapes, we've been able to get access to 46 states now for domestic wineries. That's different for an import winery because 19 states in the U.S., including six of the top 10 revenue markets for wine, forbid specifically in their regulations import brands being sold D2C. And the simple phrase that they have in their regs that does that says the product must be produced or bottled in the United States.
It pretty much is cut and dry in those states, right?
Right. But there's still 26 states that have no restriction, four of the top 10 revenue markets, that allow for an imported brand to be sold in a method to the consumer.
Can you dive into the process for moving into D2C? Got to be some steps that can be taken.
Well, it's complicated. Right? Three areas that I have found, three pathways, I guess, that all have varying degrees of margin and footprint, the number of states you can reach. The marketplace model, there's a number of marketplaces that are springing up, particularly in the last couple of years here in the U.S. And I think COVID drove a lot of that as well, the creation of some new marketplaces in which an import brand could become a part. They're still going to have to find a legal way to transact that. And maybe that is through a sale to a traditional wholesaler who is helping them do that. Secondly, there's a modified three-tier method that allows the brand owner to have a cart on their site and work through platforms that are set up, but it is three-tier. They're moving through a technology company into a retailer with a step in between in which the wholesaler is a part of the transaction, but is not a complete part of it as in the original model. Again, it's complicated, but that's one of the platforms that's available. And finally, you know, some import brands are just realizing if they come to the U.S. and set up their own offices, they can apply for and they can own an import license, a retail license, a wholesale license. California is a very friendly state for that. And you could have a 9, 17, 20 combination, not to get geeky, but you could do that as an import brand. But you have to have an office here in the U.S. and you have to be able to be working from that office as your place of registration. So that's yet another way, but that's limited because then you are acting effectively as a retailer, which, as we know, in our country, any retailer is kind of limited to 15 states plus the District of Columbia.
Yeah, well, one thing is for sure, we also know that anything involving alcohol and the shipping of alcohol is going to be complex and highly regulated. That's for sure. The common denominator there.
And, it's very important that the importers understand that and that those rules are followed. I had an interesting conversation with a client recently that I was explaining why they had to get a place of business first before they could apply for their license. And they were saying to me, well, in Europe, we don't do it that way. We do it exactly the opposite. Why do I have to have a place of business? And I was trying to explain that because the license application requires you have a place of business to be able to have the license application. And that was, and I don't mean to be funny and I'm not punning it, but that was completely foreign to the way they do business overseas.
It just points out the differences in the models in any country if you're not familiar with it. And ours is obviously very complicated here. Because of the complication, because of all the nuances, what are the things that international brands should be thinking about and being prepared to do as they contemplate trying to break into the US D2C market?
Touching on the last point is they need to understand, they need to follow the rules. They need to operate in a manner on this side of the bright line, as we'd say, and they need to do that and be conscious of that. Secondly, to do this effectively, they have to understand what resources they're going to put against their direct-to-consumer effort. It's not just find a pathway and turn the store on and hope wine gets sold. They need to understand that there's going to have to be someone managing that process. They're going to have to do list building. They're going to have to do e-commerce work. They're going to have to create emails. They're going to have to create campaigns. There needs to be someone dedicated to, and most importantly, a budget dedicated to the effort to help get the direct-to-consumer effort started through a legal pathway. Really, candidly, can't be operated from a remote time zone because you've got genuine customer service issues. Issues which you would not have in a traditional three-tier model because those would be handled by the retailer, the restaurant, the distributor, etc. But when you're dealing directly with consumers, things happen, right? Your business, you've been doing this for a long time. Things happen.
They do.
When you're shipping wine. Yeah. So That's the two
shipping-wise.
most important things I think they need to understand. Live by the letter of the law and really understand how much you're going to put against your DTC effort in time and in budgets.
Well, and because you don't want to do it halfway, if you're going to break into the market and you're going to spend the initial time trying to develop that one-on-one relationship, you have to be able to support it and sustain it over time.
Correct.
And so that requires resources.
Keyword you just said is time. It can't just be we're going to do this for 2 or 3 months and hope everything works. We all joke about it, right? We're in the wine business. It's a marathon, not a sprint. But so is marketing. So is brand building. So is e-commerce sales. You have to build relationships. You have to be consistent in your look and feel, and you have to be consistent in the amount of time you put into knowing you're going to invest in this. So that's something I talk to people about is you've got money to do this now, but you really need to think about this past 12 months. What are you doing year two to support this effort? And at what point in time are you going to say, this is my marker for either break even or how much I want to invest? But you have to make the decision long before you get to that point of how long we're going to put into this and invest in it to make it work.
Yeah, I think another thing that goes hand in glove with that concept is the fact that they have to remember that the entire domestic market has woken up and has really upped their game. When you and I spoke last, we said that COVID kind of acted like the old Y2K impetus. It really created an inertia around digital marketing,
yes,
direct marketing, technology upgrades. So the entire US market, all the wineries here have upped their game. They
yes,
know
they
that there's, you have to do a better job to take advantage and ride this wave. So while the international brands looking at this market and how big it is are very excited about it, they also have to be able to understand that the competition has gotten greater, correct?
A great example of that, about June of last year, I was talking to an industry colleague and they said, you know, I was looking at some numbers. And if you think about the average rate of growth of e-com in the wine space in the last 10 years, we have as an industry grown 10 years in 3 months. So yes, people who were doing it stepped up their game. People who didn't know what they were doing were trying to get into the game. And then there's another whole cohort of people that didn't even know the game was going on, trying to figure out, how do I sell this wine? The industry was broadly unprepared in the United States for this, but those that responded have definitely raised the bar. So yes, that's yeah, something an international brand would be competing against.
So Brian, I know you have a handful of international clients that you're helping, bringing them into the States. How exactly do you help them or advise them?
Well, first and foremost, I need to determine if they're the kind of a brand that understands the two things we talked about. I want you to operate in a legal manner, and I want to make sure you have resources against it. So after the vetting takes place, I then work with them to find the right pathway to market, is the program I have. It's a roadmap. It's essentially the licensing. Now, again, I'm not an attorney. I'm very deeply invested in and have a lot of knowledge in this area, but I'm not giving them legal advice. I'm simply saying this is what's out there and here's some examples of people doing it. Then the next thing is I want to work with them, some of them on best practices. Who are the right vendors to work with? Who are the right companies to align with? How do you do list building? How do you build e-commerce strategies? How do you do an email? Things like that. I talked to them about brand building, which is also important because these are brands that are established in a foreign country that may not have a lot of awareness here in the US. Very, very competitive. I mean, there's 11,000 wineries in the US alone and many, many thousands more around the world that want to be in this market. And then last but not least, what I work with a couple of them on is wholesale and direct-to-consumer recommendations and introductions. I'm in a very fortunate position, having been in the business a long time, to be able to introduce people, particularly on the wholesale side, to each other to say, let's see if you guys can do business. I'm not involved in that, but I can offer the recommendation and I can offer the introduction.
Well, I can't thank you enough for giving us your time today, your insights. This is obviously going to be an area that continues to grow and the interest is very, very high and probably will continue. I look forward to maybe having you come back and we can catch up again sometime later and figure out if some of our predictions and our thoughts and everything are coming true.
I'd very much enjoy that. And Milton, once again, thank you very much for spending some time with me to talk through this. It's a fascinating area. It's kind of a fun area, a little geeky. It's a little scary, but at the end of the day, you know, what drives me in my passion is to introduce more people to the beverage of wine and enjoy that beverage. And this is just one little way that I can do that. And you've helped me do that today. So thank you very much.
Thank you. I think we're all interested in figuring out how we help grow the wine industry in general. That's what's just such a wonderful thing about being a part of it. Truly is.
Absolutely.